Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. This is Theology Thursday. Typically, we look at the news of the day from a Christian worldview. Today, we look at the source of the Christian worldview, God's Word.
We continue our study on the Exodus law. Now, let's read the whole of this second commandment, again, starting in verse 4 of Exodus 20. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands to those who love me and keep my commandments. All right. Visiting the iniquity to the third and fourth generation. Is God here saying that he will punish the great-grandkids of the people who are evil? Is that what he's saying? Well, the same Moses who wrote Exodus wrote Deuteronomy. And in Deuteronomy 24, there's a principle in verse 16. It says this: fathers shall not be put to death for their children, nor shall the children be put to death for their fathers. A person shall be put to death for his own sin. You shall not pervert justice. That's the beginning of the next verse. So there's a principle of justice. You don't punish someone for someone else's sin. In fact, that's part of the story of the whole Bible. Because of Adam's sin, we all inherited death, and we'll go to hell because we're dead spiritually and we're dying physically. However, Christ died, and when he died, he paid the debt for Adam's sin, so that just as in Adam all died, through Christ all have been justified. That's in Romans 5. So a little baby that's born, when he is born, is he born guilty? No. He's born innocent. Now he has the flesh, which will be this strong tendency to sin as soon as he gets the opportunity. You don't have to teach your kids to sin. They figure that out on their own. But when little babies die, do they die with the guilt of Adam on their souls? No. Romans 5, that Christ paid for Adam's sin, so they were justified of Adam's sin. All right, so there's the principle. You don't punish someone for someone else's sin. God is a just God. So then why does it say here, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generations? Well, while it is unjust to punish someone for his great-grandfather's sin, the law of cause and effect is not just or unjust. It's just a cold, harsh reality, the law of cause and effect. The laws are ruthless. All the laws, the criminal law, the physical law, the spiritual law. If a man throws his child into a fire, the physical laws brutally envelop that child, and he dies for the sins of his father. Unless, of course, there is an intervention. If a father is an alcoholic or mocks God, and he lets his children roam free, and he doesn't protect them from fornication or from Hollywood's promotion of immorality, then the physical and spiritual laws will surround that child and suffocate him, unless there is an intervention and he breaks free somehow, because the sins of his father and grandfather will destroy his life unless someone somehow intervenes. If a father is a criminal, whether convicted or not, if he's a rapist, a kidnapper, a murderer. Think of what will happen to his children. Think of O.J. Simpson's children, John Ramsey's children, Bill Clinton's child. The laws will snuff the life right out of them unless an intervention, someone, comes between these children and the natural fruit of their parents. The kids will be destroyed unless they come to stand against the wickedness of their own parents. And you know how hard that is? To stand against your parents? It's easy to do if your parents are standing for truth, because rebellion is natural in the heart of a child. But when your parents are wicked, then you'll find a love and devotion from kids. If not for their parents generally, at least for the wicked. The third command, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who has taken his name in vain. Many unbelievers mention Jesus far more frequently than I do. Hear it all the time, in anger, in amazement, in judgment. They attempt to mock him with his name, but God will not be mocked. And one day, they will recognize that Jesus Christ is Lord, and they will bow to him. Hopefully, they will bow not too late. However, it is the Christians that surprise me. Oh, God, come on. Have you ever heard that? It just blows my mind. How Christians, and it's that practice of referring to God as a figure of speech, just as an exclamation, oh, God. I've noticed it in the charismatic community prevalent. It's just constant, daily, because I've spent a lot of years of my life with charismatics. And I haven't noticed it in other communities. Maybe after the study, somebody could let me know if they have. By a show of hands, has anybody noticed it elsewhere among real Christian churches? Charismatics are true Christians. It's the one place I've noticed this, and I can't figure it out. I don't understand why. It's tragic. I hope that our brothers and sisters, Pentecostals and Assemblies of God, I hope they become more aware of that offense to the Lord. And it's not that we are under the law. We're not. We will not be judged by the law. But that doesn't mean we want to sin. Because we're freed from the law and delivered from the law does not mean that we want to go out and find sins and commit them. Sin is still devastating. And we still, of course, want to honor God even more so now that we're not under the law. The fourth command, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Years ago, I was invited by a church to preach a sermon, and I preached it on the law. And it was a lot of fun. And back then, I realized that the average Christian was obsessed with keeping the law. Even the Christian who believed that you're saved by grace and not the law, they're still obsessed with keeping the law. And I wanted to preach a sermon that would make a difference. And I wanted to tell them that the law kills, but God gives life. And I wanted to show them, give them a way to remember that up until this point in their Christian life, they've really been siding with the law and against God. So I thought, how can I do that? Because you could preach a sermon and people hear it and they nod their heads. Then they just go on with their lives. And they forget that they heard anything new. So I thought, before the sermon, I'm going to pass out a little sheet of paper with a question on it. And the question said, does it benefit a Christian to keep the Ten Commandments? And there was a yes and a no. And I asked everybody to circle the answer. And we took a moment, and everybody in the church circled. And for the most part, every single person, pretty good-sized group, circled yes. It benefits a Christian to keep the Ten Commandments, except for the pastor. He had to give a qualifier. He circled yes, but he wrote nine of them, which I got a kick out of. That was really funny, because you're either under the law or you're not. It's not like you can't put your toes in. You just can't do that. The Bible warns us that the law is one law. And Paul and James tell us, If you're under one part of it, you're under all of it. You can't pick and choose. Because he who said, thou shalt not murder, also said, thou shalt not commit adultery. It's one law. And if you break one part of it, you're guilty of all because it's one law. So you can't be under just part of it. So it's good to keep nine of them, but not the tenth. And the tenth he was referring to was this one. Remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. Verse 9, 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, you, nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant, nor your female servant, nor your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gates. For in 6 days, and notice oftentimes it's pointed out that the Ten Commandments are summarized when Jesus said, love God and love your neighbor. These are the two main commandments, Jesus said, and they are. And they summarize the whole Mosaic Law. And the whole Mosaic Law is summarized, capsulized in the Ten Commandments. They say these first four are the law toward God, and the next six are the law toward man. But notice in this Sabbath law, it's a bit hard to classify it as toward God or toward man. Because remember the Sabbath, and don't have your servants or your kids work 7 days a week. Don't work them like animals. Don't even work animals like animals. Let them rest. Right? Let them rest. And so is this law toward God or law toward man? It sort of spans the two. But we know that it's a symbolic law. It's not absolute morality. It's not absolute spirituality. Like, love God, honor Him. That's absolute. And when we'll get to do not murder and do not steal, those are absolute principles, moral justice. But do not work on Saturday, that's not an absolute. That's a symbol. And in this book of Exodus, later on, we'll read that God says the Sabbath is a symbol of my covenant with Israel. That's what it is. That's why Paul, when he explains in Romans chapter 11 that God has cut off Israel and grafted in the body of Christ, then in Romans 14, he's no longer concerned whether you keep the Sabbath. It doesn't matter. Israel had to keep the Sabbath, but we don't, because it wasn't a fundamental moral principle. Noah didn't keep the Sabbath. He'd never heard of it. In 2,500 years, there's no command to keep the Sabbath until the Israelites with Moses. In the book of Exodus, it appears suddenly. So it's a symbol. And notice verse 11, which is part of the Sabbath command. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Now, the Ten Commandments refute the gap theory. The gap theory is, you know, in Christians back about a century ago, they were worried because evolution had come on really strong. Charles Darwin, 1859, published Origin of the Species. All the fossil record was being dug up, the dinosaurs, and the evolutionists who hated God, they said, well, you know, these fossils are millions of years old, 60 million, 80 million years old, 100 million years old. You know that whole geologic column, and they tell us how old each of those eras are and epochs and ages, how old they were? And we think, oh, well, they got those ages by modern science because they dated them with radioactive dating mechanisms, and that's how they found out when the Pleistocene period was or the Precambrian period ended, or that's when the Jurassic period was. Well, guess what? Those ages of how old they are, they were all put in place before anybody dated anything with any radiometric test. They were put together, those dates. Who came up with those dates? People who hated God and thought evolution would replace God. And they thought through, it's a little hard to believe that the eye could evolve by chance. Obviously, it would take a long time. How long? So they gave themselves plenty of time. The whole geologic column, they just guessed it at all. And lo and behold, when radiometric dating came into existence, it doesn't work, but it's supposed to. But you know what? It didn't displace those dates and correct them. They kept all the dates because they just adjust the dating to match the dates that the evolutionists had come up with. The Christians were worried. Darwin published his book. Oh boy, what are we going to do? They forgot that the great scientists in the history of the world, like Galileo and Isaac Newton, Johann Kepler, so many of the greatest scientists were Christians, according to the definition that we use today. Not that they were born in Europe, but that they were Christians. They defended the Bible as the Word of God. And aggressively, they devoted huge chunks of their lives to defending the Scriptures. They forgot that. And they thought that these quasi-scientists would rule the day. So they invented a gap theory. And they wanted to know, how could you jive evolution with the Bible? So they said, between the first two sentences was a period of millions of years or billions of years. It was a great age. God created the whole earth and everything in it. And then for some reason, it was all destroyed. And then Genesis 1:2, he started to recreate it millions of years later. So that's the gap theory. Well, what does this verse say in the Ten Commandments? In 6 days, the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. That simple sentence does not allow for any gap period beyond a 24-hour day. It doesn't fit. Because in 6 days, the Lord made the heavens and the earth. Now, the gap theorists say the Lord made the heavens and the earth, right? Verse 1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And then, by the time you get to verse 2, it's millions of years later. And then God made all the life in the seas and on the earth and the man and all that. Doesn't work. In 6 days, God made the heavens, the earth, the sea, and all that is in them. Johann Kepler, by the way, the father of physical astronomy, stated and wrote his belief that the earth was about 6,000 years old. And he worked. He's the one who gave us the three fundamental laws of the planets, the motions of the planets. And so he took that knowledge and he tried to calculate backwards. Because with those formulas, you can determine where the planets will be at some point in the future. So they used to be able to predict eclipses because they observed, but they didn't understand why the planets moved the way they did. But Kepler figured it all out and came up with much more accurate formulas because he really figured out the true math behind the solar system. And so you could calculate where the planets will be in years from now. And Kepler knew, being a scientist and a mathematician, I could run the formulas backward. And I could try to figure out where the planets would be at the time of Christ. And maybe I could find the conjunction that would have been the Star of Bethlehem. So he tried to do that. He spent a good chunk of time working on that, Johann Kepler. And we built on his efforts and have a video called The Planets, the Stars, and the Bible. And it's fun. If you haven't seen it, we take software that is a simulator of the solar system, and it has all the planets, some of the moons, and thousands of the stars, and it's all in a computer database. And you could type in any date, any city or location on Earth, time of day, and you could see what the sky looked like. And so we go back to the time of Christ and the birth of Christ, and we look at the skies, and we see this dramatic conjunction of Regulus and Jupiter, and what the meaning of that conjunction would have been back then with those stars, the star and the planets, and what they mean, and the constellation that it occurs in. It's all very, very dramatic. So if you'd ever like to, you could certainly buy one, or we'd be happy to loan it to you if you'd like to see that. All right, the fifth commandment, honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God is giving you. It's often said that this is the first command with the promise that you'll live long. But it's not said why. because otherwise God will kill you. Honor your father and your mother, or you're dead meat. You know, and I want to touch on, we know that we're supposed to honor our parents. You know, generally, parents care for their children constantly, full-time for years, and part-time for at least a couple decades, and then at least somewhat for half a century. Generally, that's what parents do for their kids. And when you turn that around, when kids need to care for their parents, after a few months, I've had about all I can take. And then it's off to the nursing home or whatever. And that's really wrong. God burns when he sees that. I, hopefully, as much as anyone, know how dangerous it is to make a law, to make up a rule, and then think that other people have to go by your rule. That's real dangerous. But knowing that, I just like to give out a warning about nursing homes. Generally, I think that on Judgment Day, many people are going to be shamed and punished severely because of the use of nursing homes as a way to get rid of their parents. Today, if an elderly person breaks a hip, falls down and breaks a hip, that's a life sentence, or we should say a death sentence, because they get put in a nursing home. And I've spent quite a lot of time in nursing homes, not thousands of hours, but 100 hours or so. And they're terrible places. I've spent a lot of time in jail, you know, a couple weeks worth, working weeks worth in nursing homes. And nursing homes are hell on earth. You go and you visit and they show how wonderful it is and how they take care of the people. And the people there hate it. They hate it with a passion. And I've visited people because of the show around the country in nursing homes. And it's always exactly the same. Doesn't matter how expensive they are, it's like hell. So I'd ask people to reconsider. A lot of adults say, starting in their 50s and 60s and 70s, I want to go in a nursing home. They say that. I want to. Why do they say that? Why do they say I want to? I think I know why. Because they're afraid of the devastating torment to realize that their children will not love them and care for them. That pain is far worse than being imprisoned in a hell house. That pain of your kids saying, I don't love you enough to care for you. So in our family, my mom, she's still young. So maybe it's easy for us. She plays tennis all the time. But we've all said, when if she gets old enough that she can't make it on her own, we want her. But there's four of us. So what are we going to do? We figured we'd have an auction, and we'd auction her off. And the highest bidder of our four kids would get my mom, and she'd get the money. So, and of course, she also says, oh, I could go and visit one to the other. And it's, you know, I've seen people taking care of parents, and it is very difficult, and it totally changes your life, but it's worth it. Honor your father and your mother. Why? Well, if you don't, you're not a good kid. You're not raised a healthy kid. Why do parents teach their kids to obey and respect mom and dad? It's because they love the kids. The parents who don't love the kids are the ones who let the kids do what they want. The parents who don't honor the kids allow their kids to behave in ways dishonoring of their parents. And this command explains why God tells us to worship Him. I've had a caller on the show say, that Christian God is so weak and he's so needy because he demands for people to worship him. And he threatens them. And he says, if you don't worship me, I will punish you. But what a weak God. And it's the exact opposite. God knows that if we don't honor him and obey him, then we will destroy ourselves. It's the good parent that goes out of his way and puts up with all the difficulty to get the kids to obey and honor and respect. The sixth command, you shall not murder. God hates the shedding of innocent blood, both born and unborn. And you know, when I'm with a lot of pro-lifers, We got to focus sometime, go out of our way to focus on the born. One of the big criticisms against us, some pro-lifers are, where people say, you care about the unborn, you don't care about them after they're born. Now, that's generally not true of pro-lifers. But in respect to murder, when someone is murdered, the anger that a pro-lifer can feel when somebody's murdering an unborn child. But if it's a six-year-old JonBenet Ramsey or Nicole Brown Simpson, middle-aged, unfaithful, or even a 20-year-old homosexual Matthew Shepard, the righteous indignation that we feel when they kill unborn children, we should also be able to recognize in our conscience, in our being, when we see older people murdered. And there should be a passion there also. The shedding of all innocent blood should anger us. And this brief command illustrates the danger of disobeying all of God's law, because rebellion leads to death. The seventh command, you shall not commit adultery. Faithfulness toward God, toward your spouse, toward your children. That's what it's all about. And so the marriage covenant is a symbol of our relationship with God. And if we learn to be faithful to one another, we can be faithful to God. The eighth commandment, you shall not steal. And this, in a way, describes most of the other commandments. Idolatry is stealing. Worship due God. Murder is stealing someone else's life. Adultery is stealing someone else's wife or virginity. Even forcing someone to work without rest is stealing. Stealing is wrong. Thus, it leads to death. Thus, God outlawed it. Communism, socialism, property tax, these are all stealing. On our ShadowGov headquarters door, we've had a bumper sticker for some long time now, years. It says, don't steal. The government hates competition. And someone said to me just this past week, well, at least the government should take care of little kids. You know, if the parents don't provide health care, the government should. Well, the government would have to steal money to do that. And then the parents would be disinclined to be responsible to take care of their own kids. So no matter for what purpose, how you slice it, it's destructive. And the ninth command, which is perjury, verse 16, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. That's perjury. That's criminal justice. Notice how these laws are starting to feel like we're in a law school with thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not commit perjury. In the 10th command, you shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, nor his male servant, nor his female servant, nor his ox, nor his donkey, nor anything that is your neighbor's. Coveting, it's not a crime, but it's a sin. And it leads to death, an unhealthy desire for that which belongs to another.
Hi, folks. Doug McBurney here. Keeping Bob Enyart Live on the radio gives him the ability to promote godly ideas on the terrestrial airwaves. I'm asking you to go online to purchase any or all of Bob's eye-opening Christian resources available in written, audio, or video formats. Go to kgov.com and come alongside Bob's vital ministry and keep Bob broadcasting on the radio. That's kgov.com, kgov.com right now, to give Bob the essential support that only you can offer.